What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere. Visit Hyland.com.
The Football Pod with Paddy and Andy.
Yes, Dublin aren't in great form, but they're bored out in their mind. Paul Mannion and Jack McCaffrey aren't playing, yes, because of the stress and the strain, but they're a bit bored.
Download the OTB Sports app and subscribe to the GAA podcast feed now.
OTB AM. With Gillette, put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.
It is 7:30. This is OTB AM. Owen and Aisling O'Reilly with you right the way through until 10 o'clock this morning. And only one story in town today, I think it's fair to say. Kelly Harrington is now an Olympic finalist. She has been upgraded from an Olympic medalist to an Olympic finalist, we can say for certain. And she will fight for a gold medal on Sunday morning against Brazil's Beatriz Ferreira. It's going to be one hell of a fight. She's up against one hell of an opponent, but it was one hell of a performance this morning from Kelly Harrington against Si Sondi of Thailand. And she has guaranteed herself a silver medal. Of course, she's not going to settle for that. She's going to be absolutely desperate for gold. And only once in the history of the Olympic Games have Ireland had two different people win a gold medal in the same Olympic Games. That was way back in 1932 in Los Angeles when Bob Tizzle and Pat O'Callaghan won gold on the very same day. It has been an up and down Olympic Games for Ireland, I think it's fair to say, over the last little while. But Harrington on Sunday has the chance to make this Games a truly historic one and a truly brilliant one for Ireland at this stage. And I guess, Aisling, and good morning to you, by the way. This is already a phenomenal story for Kelly Harrington.
Good morning, Owen. Yeah, just unbelievable. Just watching her this morning, you know, it's hard to watch because you know what this means to her. She's 31 years of age and she's making her debut at the Olympics. Some people say she was a bit of a late bloomer to it all, but the hard work that's going in behind the scenes for Kelly has been unbelievable. And you can hear what it means to her family, to Portland Row. And she always mentions Noel Burke, her coach back home. And yeah, it's just great to see. And what a personality as well. Like, I've talked to Kelly a few times now, a few occasions. I've interviewed her and she's something else. Like, she's an absolute ticket. Like, she's hilarious. And yeah, it's just great to see. So yeah, hopefully she goes all the way. But as she says, she doesn't mind at this stage the medals. It doesn't bother her. Like, what she's done, it's been immense. And yeah, she's a true champion to all of us anyways.
I'm not sure how you felt watching the fight this morning, but I wasn't overly calm, I'm not going to lie. But looking at Kelly Harrington afterwards, as she's been saying, no worries and absolutely no problem to her. It seemed, she seemed far more relaxed than I was watching it. I'm not sure what your emotions were.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh my God. No, it was hard to watch because it was so cagey, especially in the first round, especially, you know, when you could see the ref coming in and telling them, right, come on, you know, he's inviting the two of them to compete. And you could see what was on the line. And that was the reason that I suppose they weren't all going for it hell for leather, because they don't want to make a mistake. You know, it's an Olympic final that's on the line. They don't want to be caught, you know, and go in off the front foot and get caught. And I suppose they both had similar styles too, and that was something that played a part in it. But yeah, you could really see her experience and maybe her age sort of coming through there, that she was so calm. She waited, she took her time, she took the right shots, she was listening to her corner. And yeah, it came off her. But yeah, it was cagey. Yeah, and you didn't know what way it was going to go at the end either. You didn't know what way it was going to be called. It was that close, but brilliant. Brilliant.
Well, let's hear from the woman of the hour, Kelly Harrington.
I tell you what, like, regardless of the colour of the medal, like, obviously, yeah, it's a massive, massive thing, a massive achievement. But regardless of the colour of the medal, to have the support of the people back home, to put a smile on the nation's face, if I had a winning here today or not, I would have told them to keep smiling, because it's still an incredible journey, you know, and I'm just happy to be able to lift all of those people. And it's just great. It's you know, I know I don't look really happy because my emotions and my relief has just hit the floor, because I can't really believe what's happening. But yeah.
How was your relief this morning, Ronan Mullen?
Oh, it was it's what the Irish boxing journey has been on this whole Olympics in microcosm, where a bit of calmness, a bit of confidence early on, drifted a little bit in the middle. Not that things were going overly wrong, but you're just getting a little bit tetchy. And then she came out for that third round and put on an absolute virtuoso clinic, really. Absolutely brilliant stuff. When all the chips were down, she delivered in the best way possible. And I think roll on Sunday, I think everybody's buzzing for it now.
Can you explain to us what her tactical approach would have been to the fight overall from what you've gleaned from, I presume you haven't watched it back yet, but the three rounds that we did see?
Yeah, like obviously the notable thing in the early going was the referee sort of warning them. It's something we've seen a couple of times in this Olympics where, and it's the want of amateur referees in large part really to kind of encourage fighters to engage. It was a chess match, as Kelly alluded to in her post-fight interview. And it was in these instances where both boxers are going to back their technical skills. It's kind of, they're kind of coaxing the other one to blink first. And that's how the first minute or so played out. Cessondi, I actually felt, was the one who pressed the action ever so slightly in that opening half of the first round. But once Kelly found a rhythm, you could see she had the advantage. It played out in a similar fashion to the 2018 final, which she referenced as well. And then she developed a foothold, I would have thought, into that first round, as was borne out in the scorecards. The second round was a bit strange. I don't know if it was a tactical ploy from Kelly or a mindset thing. She did seem to, she was still doing all her feinting and her lateral movement and perpetual motion with her upper body, but she wasn't following that up with the shots that she was towards the end of the first round. So I'm not sure what quite happened there. Cessondi did come into her own, and again, the scorecards narrowed a bit. So the third round, it seemed like it was all to play for, and like she was just phenomenal. She came out and really forced the issue in that third round. A lot of front foot stuff, and as we've touched on in our previous calls, Owen, the way she switched from Southport to Orthodox, like you can prepare for Cessondi as accomplished a fighter as she is. You know what you're going to get. With Kelly Harrington, you just don't know what you're going to get, because she starts Southport, she's segues to Orthodox briefly. Again, Southpaw in the second round, spots of Orthodox, and then Orthodox for the third round, where she kind of laid a marker down and showed she could win in any fashion possible. So, yeah, I think in terms of what she's put on tape at these Olympics, she's shown such a breadth of skills that she will fancy her chances on Sunday, as we saw in the second semi-final. If that was a chess match, the first one, the second one was like Call of Duty or Street Fighter or something like that. It really was hell for leather stuff. So again, we know what's coming on Sunday. You would back Kelly to be able to deal with it, hopefully.
Why does she come out in the third round in an orthodox stance? Is that herself, do you think, saying, right, okay, I'm going to mix this up a little bit? Do you think Conlon and Zara are telling her that?
Yeah, because as we said the other day, often she will just find herself switching stances, which is what the very best people do, where they'll just sort of slalom in between both, whereas it seemed like a pretty decisive thing that she spent a good portion of the second half of the fight in the orthodox stance against the southpaws. So obviously, as we said before, southpaws aren't used to coming up against southpaws. It's just by dint of the rarity of their supremacy in boxing that the best ones get to the top, but there's very few beneath. So for Cessondi, the picture was always changing, and I think that was just something. It was sort of Kelly's ace in the pack that she knew she could change things up if the need arose. Again, I wasn't quite sure. It wasn't as if the fight was like rolling away from her in the second round or anything like that. It just seemed to be a bit of a stalemate, and Cessondi, just by dint of her probably more aggressive approach, was nicking that in the mind's eye. But you know, any doubt in that regard was quickly quashed with a decisive final round from Harrington. And it's the first time she's probably had to navigate a tricky spell in these Olympics so far. Sunday will be 9 minutes of choppy water, so I think she'll have to get herself in the mind frame for that. But if there's one thing clear from her media dealings so far, she's taken all of this in her stride. She's sort of embracing the emotion of what she's done here for the wider community at home, and just getting that medal in the bag from a personal point of view. But like, on the horizon, the gold medal has always been in her eye, and this is her chance to have a go at it on Sunday.
It is that relaxed approach that is so impressive, Ronan, that when the chips were down, and they weren't too far down, there was still always a sense after the second round that she was still the better fighter and was still going to win. But when you're in that ring and you start to feel the tide turn ever so slightly, I'm sure there is a temptation to be like, oh God, I'm I need to show something here. I need to box aggressively and really make my mark in this fight. And she kind of stuck to her guns. She kind of just upped the intelligence even in the final round and painted a very composed picture, which is almost the most impressive thing.
Yeah, and the jeopardy of the scoring system at the moment, we don't have to go over. It's been the story of the games almost, where the sort of disparity in what's impressing who on the judges' scorecards. Like, if you go back to 2018, one of the judges gave Cess Undie the whole fight 30-27. And it was a similar case in this one where Kelly was comprehensively swaying certain judges and then had to win over certain others. And that was the case going into the third round, where she knew who she had to impress almost, and it was almost a sense of, I keep doing what I'm doing, I'm going to win here. But that change of tack, it was just such a champion's mindset, like to take the initiative in that fashion, where, yeah, she could have coasted and done what she was doing and probably would have nicked the decision anyway, but she just put a firm exclamation point on matters. And it's sort of one of the crowning moments of Irish Olympic boxing in history, I would say, just the way she took command of that third round. And if she does go on to win gold medal, that will almost be her signing off moment, that, you know, this was truly the moment where we knew Kelly Harrington was on course for the greatest of things.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, the intelligence of her. And I think maybe in that third round, does she hold back and wait, see where she's at, and then just go for it? Like, she definitely did. It looked like she'd more in the tank, but as you said, the second round was cagey, and then all of a sudden we seen Kelly come alive almost.
Yeah, it's that IQ, isn't it? Like, from, you can probably underestimate what that 2018 World Championship did for her. Obviously, this is way more of a bigger stage, but to beat the world in that fashion back 3 years ago, and sort of set in motion this run of dominance almost for Kelly Harrington. Granted, her opponent on Sunday is the reigning world champion, but Kelly had her injury issues and whatnot. But I think coming off the back of Katie Taylor's decade-long reign or whatever, I think Harrington almost needed that as a sense of assurance that, you know, she did belong at the top level. And you could hear her, I think, was after her first fight, or no, after she secured bronze, she was saying, "Sometimes I used to think I was lucky, but now I know I'm not." And you could almost see that sense of belonging as she came out for that third round, where a lesser fighter would have wilted, maybe a fighter with less experience would have wilted, but she actually relished it. She rose to the occasion in such an impressive way. And, you know, you can't say enough for her credentials and her mindset. As much as she's technically proficient, that was sort of a win of Wales as much as anything.
Yeah, you do get the sense at times, like, she is very grounded, but almost that she believes obviously how good she is, but there's a doubt there at times that I'm doing this, like, this is real, this is happening to me.
Yeah, and like, people have spoken so eloquently and brilliantly about what she represents to her community at home, and that's obviously a big driving force for what she does. Like, interesting quotes from her that, you know, irregardless of what she achieves at these games, you know, I'm not just a boxer, I'm Kelly Harrington. I think that is sincere. Some people say that almost as if to deburden themselves and kind of play down things. But I do actually think whether she comes home with a gold medal or not, she's going to be back to her old routine. And, you know, that's such a fundamental part of her life. And it's actually an incredible thing that a world-class athlete can conduct herself in this way and sort of embrace that that country ethos and that hometown ethos almost. And, you know, just as perfect a symbol for Irish sports, I would say, on the world stage as you could possibly wish to have, because as much as she's a brilliant fighter and sports person, she's a fantastic character as well. And I can imagine we're well used to her interviews. She's done plenty and, you know, she's charmed us for several years at this stage. But you can imagine now, with the international audience all eyes on her, that I'm sure she's captivating plenty overseas as well.
I think that's a really good point. And Adrian was on last week going through Ireland's most loved Irish sports people, from Katie to Lowry to Paul O'Donovan. And really, Kelly Harrington moves herself into that category immediately over the course of these games, because it really is at the Olympics when an amateur boxer can put themselves in the shop window like that, and everybody becomes aware not only of the fighter that she is, but of the person that she is. And people become aware of her backstory and her job and the work that she does and the importance of her in the community in North Dublin and that sort of stuff will really, I guess, magnetise her to the public if it hasn't done already. And, I mean, she doesn't even need to win on Sunday, even though we'll get into that in just a moment, Ronan, but she's already got a place, I think, in the hearts of every Irish sports fan and every Irish person who's even paid a passing interest to her career.
Yeah, there's just such a realness to her, isn't there? It's sort of a possibly a misnomer to say she's relatable because she's an elite international athlete, world class. I could probably not relate to her in a million years, but in terms of how she presents herself and like the familial links and that sense of community that I mentioned, you know, everybody can relate to that. And the fact that she can exhibit it and sort of channel it in such an extraordinary way, I think that's why the Irish people are able to get behind her. And, you know, at 31, and, you know, the point has been made, that is sort of prime boxing age, but the fact that she's had to bide her time and quite cognizantly so, that like she obviously back in Rio in 2016, she won at the World Championships. She got a silver medal there, but at 64 kgs, a non-Olympic weight, and she would have been watching sort of the rumblings in Rio and what went down there. I think she was doing TV analysis and thinking, you know, I should really be there. I have the talent to be there. And Tokyo was always going to be the prime target, with Katie having segued over to the pro ranks. And, you know, while the journey from Rio to Tokyo has been a long one, it's been longer for Kelly than anybody when you think about it, that she's that precursor of years where she was winning titles and doing really well at boxing, but couldn't get that Olympic chance until now. And talk about seizing with both hands, you know what I mean? It's all well and good being put in a position, being the top seed, getting a nice favourable draw. But when the chips were down, in a really difficult semi-final, she delivered in spades, and she's going to have to deliver in spades of plenty on Sunday, because it's a super difficult task.
Yeah.
The positive obviously is that we know what we're getting. So she mentioned that she'd be chatting to Noel Burke and the Team Ireland coaches obviously, and coming up with a game plan. The game plan would probably be clear from Kelly Harrington, but it's just about execution. And as Mira Pakkinen, who's an elite fighter in her own right, top fighter, had no answer for what Ferrer was bringing to proceedings today. So mouthwatering final on Sunday in prospect, but I think everyone behind Harrington, the few people who didn't set their alarms for 6 a.m. this morning will be setting them for 6 a.m. on Sunday, I'm sure, and the whole country will be behind her.
That's for sure. And that's a good point you make about Potkin and just no answer earlier on. I think pretty terrifying Ferreira's performance earlier on, but I'm getting the sense, Ronan, from what you're talking about, that it will be a totally different fight when she comes up against Kelly Harrington. She'll come up against a better game plan on Sunday, and anybody who was like me a little bit blown away by Ferreira this morning, she's not going to have that dominance on Sundays, is what you can assure us, is what I'm gathering here.
Yeah, like I think the important thing for Kelly, and I know it's only a 9 minute fight, but she has to prove that she can stick with Ferreira physically. That's going to be quite important, you know, earn her respect. And, you know, while Kelly is more of a fleet of foot and is a crisp puncher, I think she has to like earn Ferreira's respect with, you know, decent power shot in the early going, just to sort of show that while she'll back her slick skills and sort of lateral movement and ring generalship to win this fight on the scorecards, that like it's she has to arrest the tide that Ferreira is going to be bringing, because her style is going to be non-stop pressure. And I don't want to do her a disservice either, you know, a very technically accomplished fighter in her own right, but her engine is just incomparable. She's going to be a tough one to defuse, but I think Kelly, as you said, has the angles to do it, has the wherewithal to do it, has the acumen to do it. And as she's going to have to paint that picture that we talked about, she's going to have to give Pereira a different picture in every round and almost, you know, win the judges over that way, because if it's on work rate, it's going to be a difficult one. But if it's on boxing skills, you'd back Kelly Harrington every day of the week.
Right. Well, that's a really encouraging note to leave it on. Ronan, great stuff this week as ever, and we'll hopefully chat to you with even better news next week.
Yeah, thanks a million, folks.
Cheers. Ronan Mullen there on the line, and I'm sure you'll be able to hear his stuff later on the PM show as well. It is 7:49 on this Thursday morning. OTB AM brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Let's tell you what's coming up for the rest of the show this morning. We have got Michael Carruth on standby, who is going to talk to us about what it's like to fight in a gold medal match at the Olympic Games. That is, of course, what Kelly Harrington is going to be facing into on Sunday morning. We're going to have plenty more Olympics reactions action after 8 o'clock. Will O'Callaghan has been watching everything this morning and will bring you up to speed on everything. Sports pages coming your way at 8:05. Plenty on the lines there in the sports pages, which we'll get into at around 8:20 with Cian Tracy of the Irish Independent. Some interesting quotes from Warren Gatland on rugby and the style of play that it's going down and the route it's going down stylistically at the moment. Ashling will be chatting us through semi-finals in the All-Ireland Women's Football. Ross Tucker will be with us at 8:40 to Cass and I over the last few days on the track in Tokyo. It's been really, really interesting and looking forward to getting his take. Neil Tracy then will be with us after 9:05 for a little bit more preview ahead of his commentary of the third test this Saturday in the British and Irish Lions Tour to South Africa. The Burns brothers will be back with us again. They are part of the Dublin Simon Run at Home event at the moment, a brilliant charity event, and they'll be chatting us through that and a little bit of a kicking masterclass and the mentality of kicking as well coming up at around 9:20. So that is the table set for you this morning. It is 7:50. We will get to Michael Carruth in just a moment, just to give you a bit of a flavour of what's on the back pages this morning. The Irish Examiner leads with living the dream. What a time to be a Limerick hurler, says Garrod Hegarty, as they continue their build up to All-Ireland semi-final weekend in the hurling. The Herald goes with Pogba staying put for now. Solskjaer still hopes to keep his United midfield star, with Paris Saint-Germain waiting in the wings. And a photo there of Tanya Watson creating history to become Ireland's first female diver at the Olympics. She got through to the semi-finals, but unfortunately that is where her Tokyo quest ended. The Irish Times leads with a photo there of Stephanie Meadow, who has been out on the course again this morning, herself and Leona Maguire, going pretty well actually in the women's golf competition there. And temperature is rising for tournament organisers, says Johnny Waterson. Sweltering heat takes heavy toll and leaves officials on horns of a dilemma. And Cole claims Mboma's 200 metre silver shows rules are working. That's a really interesting story, which we will get into with Ross Tucker a little bit later on. The Irish Mirror: Jumping Jack Cash is their headline, as Jack Grealish has completed his £100 million move to Manchester City. It is quite the fee for Jack Grealish, and you'd wonder how much Tottenham are going to look for Harry Kane as a result of seeing that. Jumping Jack Cash is exactly the same headline on the back of the Irish Daily Star. Grealish deal will smash Prem transfer record, and Rochford warns of Dublin backlash. So you can expect around this time next week that the Dublin versus Mayo preview content will turn itself up to 11, but we've already started to see it this week. The back page of the Irish Daily Mail: out of picture, League of Ireland managers fume over lack of television coverage. Bowes and Rovers are outraged at the blanking of their European adventures by mainstream television. And Gatland wants extra time if series ends level. The London Times leads with the Grealish story. City land £100 billion Grealish. Champion set to announce British record transfer, while Villa sign Ings. Danny Ings, one hell of a signing. They've already used that cash pretty well, it seems. Nathan was on with us here yesterday on Deal or No Deal, and he predicted that Tottenham Hotspur would sell Harry Kane late and then sign Danny Ings for the remaining cash, which I think wouldn't have been a bad move for Tottenham, and Villa have picked him up. So I think that's actually a really good piece of business for Aston Villa. The back page of the Irish Sun: ton and dusted. Lukaku tells Inter agree Chelsea fee, and Pep to hand Jack debut at Wembley. It is Community Shield weekend this weekend. The football is back already, but no one cares about that because there's only one sporting event that we're going to be keeping an eye on this weekend outside of the Lions, and it's going to be Sunday morning. It's going to be Kelly Harrington in a gold medal bout. One man who knows what a gold medal bout is all about is Michael Carruth. Michael, good morning to you.
Good morning, how are you guys?
How are you feeling after that? That was a little bit nervy, but I assume you knew that she was going to do it.
Yeah, it was a good first opening round for her. She definitely won the first round. I thought she would have won it by a bigger margin. Second round, you have to say the Thailand girl came back into it. And then the third round was a bit of, you know, it was touch and go in the third round. But you have to say Kelly got the better shots off at the end. And probably the last minute just creeped in there, you know. It doesn't matter how you win, as long as you win, you know, when it's in semi-finals and finals, you know. So she's in the Olympic final on the 8th of August. Amazing, all week long now, she's boxed exactly the same days that I boxed in 29 years ago. Today, I won my semi-final 29 years ago.
Right.
And I beat a Thailand boxer in the semi-final.
Yeah.
You know? So we're hoping history can repeat itself now on the 8th of August, and Kelly becomes the the first Dublin female boxer to win an Olympic gold medal.
Yeah, absolutely. Can you talk us through the mentality of medal week then, Michael? Because I assume that when you have the bronze secured, there is not a level of satisfaction, but a kind of something goes off in your brain that, oh, I've achieved something. But how quickly do you need to park that to fight well in a semi-final?
Yeah, absolutely. You can't get too carried away with, you know, obviously, your first fight is your most important fight, you know. Once you get over that first hurdle, you know, you can be lucky enough that you can be fighting for a medal in your second fight or even your third fight, which Kelly's happened to be our second fight as well. So with that, you know, once you got that, you know, mantle of becoming an Olympic medalist, it can take the pressure off you a little bit, or it can put it back onto you even more so again, because then you want to get further, you know. So, but I think it takes more pressure off you than anything else. And, you know, she was very relaxed getting into the ring tonight, or this morning again. And if she can, you know, carry that same mantle for the next couple of days, you know, obviously we live in a world of communication now. We didn't back 30 years ago. You know, we only had phone calls and, fax messages coming through, you know what I mean? So with that, you know, she's to stay off her phone as much as she can, give herself maybe, you know, half an hour, 40 minutes a day to talk to our loved ones and family and friends and what have you. But, you know, has to concentrate now for the next couple of days in, you know, getting the tactics right against this girl. But most importantly is getting over the fight, you know, getting what she needs to do, you know, get home, back to the Olympic Village, and realise that now she's in an Olympic final, she's one step away from becoming, you know, an Olympic gold medalist, and it's well in our capability, there's no question about it.
How hard is it to be as relaxed as she looks to be at the moment?
Again, you know, you can throw a lot of faces on television to look relaxed, you know. I'm sure her head is racing a million miles an hour like mine was back then as well. It's you know, it's the people around you as well will help out, you know. It's the people, you know, your coaches and your management will help out, your teammates will help out. You know, sometimes you just want to get away from the boxing as well. I actually, you know, the night before I done the Olympic final, I was doing 10-pound bowling with Paul Buttermer, you know, in the Olympic Village, you know what I mean? So it was just a, you know, keep my mind off what, you know, what was the inevitable going into an Olympic final. Listen, she's got great people around her coach at home, Noel Bourke, who I work with, great guy as well. So he'd be sending messages over as well. But again, like I said, restrict that phone thing. You know, she's here to do a job, and the job is to become an Olympic champion. And you know, no better person have we got than Kelly to try win this. You know.
Yeah, she speaks about not being on her phone at all, that a few people had asked her after her fight, would you be in touch with your parents? She said, I'll send them a message, but that's it then, you know, I won't be talking to anybody else. She puts the phone away and she's just concentrating on the task ahead. She's very, very calm. How tough is it to be that calm in that situation?
I think it's just, it's in your makeup, it's in your genetics, you know. Kelly was always that type of person as well. I was a little bit the way as well. You know, I wouldn't, you know, get too much flustered. I only thought about boxing about 15 minutes before I had to do it. You know what I mean? And if she can bring that type of thing into her head as well, let's start concentrating now 15 minutes prior to this event and start working yourself up. There's no point in doing it 2 days beforehand. She's right what she's doing in relation to her phone and her family and things like that. But again, it's one of those things. It'd be a restriction as well with the boxing as well. Like the phones will be taken off them as well, and given back at a suitable time. You know, so that's what happens as well with them when they go away on teams as well. So it's again, she doesn't need any distractions. That's what she doesn't need now. She needs now to relax the next day or two, get her weight right for the 8th of August, and give this one hell of a go, you know what I mean? And I think she can. Now, let's be honest as well, this Brazilian girl she boxed as well is no morgue. She's absolutely no morgue. I watched her fight, her semi-final there as well. She has every ray of punch that you could imagine. She likes to get into a battle, you know, which Kelly can't have her doing, you know? Kelly has to keep her up on her toes and keep her moving, you know? So, well, easier said than done sometimes, you know?
Mm. and she seems to have a serious amount of power as well. Michael, I know obviously that's it's doesn't matter what level of boxing you're fighting at, obviously that's key, but there is a way around that obviously at amateur level. And do you think that Kelly will be able to outthink Ferreira's power to a certain degree on Sunday?
Absolutely. You know, if you were to pick any boxer in the world to fight this Brazilian, you pick Kelly to fight her, you know, because Kelly has footwork. You know, she needs to keep her hands up a little bit more than she did today. You know, I know that's her style of fight. You know what I mean? But this girl can punch. You know, she packs a bit of power as well. So she just needs to, you know, concentrate more on her defensive side. But she cannot get into a war with this girl. If she gets into a war with it, it's going to suit the Brazilian. You know, Kelly needs to keep her, you know, at long range. The 1-2 slipping off her left hook and shots that land and are seen to be landing, you know, and that's what she's been doing for the whole championship. Listen, again, I kind of base it on around a 50-50 chance here, you know what I mean? So it's going to be, you know, it's going to be exciting getting up now Sunday morning at 6 o'clock to have a look at this, you know what I mean? But I hope half the nation, if not all the nation, are up supporting her.
As you mentioned at the very top, Michael, there's an opportunity here now for Dublin to have a female gold boxing medalist as well as a male gold boxing medalist at the Olympic Games. From speaking to people in boxing circles, just how much of an important influence is this woman having on the young people of Dublin at the moment?
Well, it's a cliche, you know. The Olympic Games is one of our best, you know, forms of recruitment. You know what I mean? When myself and Wayne McCullough done what we done back 29 years ago, the amount of people who joined boxing, and you know, I was always looking at the Olympic Games when I was a kid, you know, and wanted to emulate the great fighters of past, you know, when I became a boxer. So it is a huge recruitment for us, you know. It's our best form of recruitment as well. So as you said, we didn't have a great Rio Games, but a lot of countries were the same as us in that category as well. So, you know, we've bounced back and we've produced 2 medals at this Olympic Games, which is phenomenal. We're now bringing our total to 18 medals in total Irish boxing. What it does for the younger generation is it shows them that there is a better way as well. Sport is a better way in life. And, you know, she's given that in multiple interviews as well, Kelly, in a sense that, you know, she's always encouraging boys and girls to take up boxing, and this is gonna be great for not just Dublin boxing but for Irish boxing that she's in an Olympic final. And you know, we hope it'll be a big push on for kids to join boxing. Obviously, we're in a bit of a pickle here in Ireland in relation to our boxing clubs are pretty much still closed to indoor training. We can only do outdoor training. But, you know, we're hoping that restrictions will be lifted soon and we can get back to some kind of normality.
Are you guys outdoor training, like, at the moment? Are you starting to see a little bounce from even the whole team having... There have been ups and downs, but relatively there's been a lot of prominence from this Irish boxing team and a lot of good moments, even though a lot of them have ended in heartbreak ultimately. But are you starting to see a little bit of a bounce from this Olympics already?
Yeah, you know, you can feel it already, you know. There's kids wanting to join clubs, you know, already, you know, it's... You know, we had a couple of new members there want to join. You know, there's a protocol in relation to joining boxing clubs now as well. We have to adhere to Sport in Ireland and, of course, to the HSE as well, which we are all doing. So, you know, again, it's you know, this won't go away in a day or two, you know, if Kelly wins this Olympic gold medal. You know, it's not going to, you know, this is going to, you know, push every young female athlete to wanting to do what they want to do. It'll push every male athlete to become an Olympic champion as well. So it's a huge, huge boost for boxing and sport in general. When you look at the rowers, the girls doing the rowing, winning the bronze medal, and the two boys winning the gold medal, it's been a phenomenal Olympic game for us. And it's well deserved at the boxing, because, you know, we have put the work in over the years, as all the other sports have as well. But it's been a very, very good Olympic Games for Team Ireland.
Yeah, and just speaking on that, Michael, we put the work in over the years. Kelly is definitely someone who's done that. What has she been like, I suppose, growing up? I know you mentioned you'd know Burke well. She's obviously put the effort in over the years, and she is 31 now. People are saying she's a bit of a late bloomer, but she's really put that hard graft behind her.
I don't think age has anything to do with it, in the sense that, you know, skill is skill, you know, and, you know, determination and commitment is, you know, you can be any age. I was looking at what the equestrian the other day, And there was one lad, he's 62 years old on the horse. You know what I mean? So I'm not going to put age as an excuse. She's, you know, Kelly has been there a long time. There's no question about it. It's one of the things that, you know, she was probably under Katie's shadow for a long time, you know. And, you know, it's not a bad shadow to be under in relation to, you know, who Katie Taylor was and who she is still, you know. So with that, Kelly has, you know, she's age won't matter to her in that regard. She's got 3 rounds to become an Olympic champion, you know. And if you handed that to her going out in an envelope, yeah, she would have took it off you straight away, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's one of those types of things. So, but I wouldn't, the age thing won't matter to her at all in that regard, you know. I think her opponent is 29, so there's not too much in the difference between the two of them, you know.
So you got the roundabout named after you in Drimna after you won the gold medal, Michael. What will Kelly Harrington get?
Oh, listen, come here. She's in North in a city, you know, and it's a great community. Some great boxing clubs there as well. So with that, you know, listen, she's not going to the Olympic Games to have a roundabout named after. She's going to the Olympic Games to win an Olympic gold medal. You know what I mean?
And that's a good point.
The bottom line of that is. She, you know, listen, she's been really, you know, her community are phenomenal. They have always been behind her 100%, you know, and, you know, we need a little bit of laughter in our life as well in this pandemic as well. And she brings that to you as well, particularly with our little quotes from The Lion King. You know, I don't know where she's going with that one, you know, but I'm definitely going to give her a slag match with that one. You know, Hakuna Matata, there you go. You know, there's the other Olympic champion saying it now. There you go. So, but, listen, it's been an absolute great roller coaster, you know, in the last couple of weeks, you know, and to be looking at the team, and obviously Aidan Walsh needs to get a mention here as well.
Yeah,
winning the bronze medal, and unfortunately, you know, trying to emulate me doing the jump, he done his ankle in. So it's but that's what happens, you know. It's just the sheer moment when you're declared an Olympic medalist is, you know. You're part of the elite club, and when you're part of the elite club, you're part of forever, you know. So unfortunately, he done a bit of damage to himself and couldn't continue. But I'm saying he's good at now, you know, because when you see what Kelly has done now, he'd love to have gotten that far as well. But again, that's boxing, you know. I mean, it's a tough sport, and you know, you pick up injuries. You know, unfortunately, we didn't think he'd pick it up that way. He done it, you know what I mean. Mm. But life is life, you know what I mean. So
your ankle was okay in 92, was it?
Mine was bang on. I waited to the final to jump. You know what I mean? So I was okay. You know, so there's no fights after that. You know. So.
one last thing, Michael. Just can you try and put us into Kelly Harrington's head over the next few days? What was the last thing you were thinking before stepping into that ring for that final in 92? What do you think she will be thinking on Sunday morning?
Well, they'll do their tactics. They'll do that probably tomorrow. You know. And don't go overboard with, you know, the tactics, you know what I mean? Because sometimes it doesn't work, you know what I mean? And, you know, you should really have 2 or 3 plans in relation to which way this goes. Because if plan A doesn't work and if you don't have plan B, you're in trouble. So, you know, John and Zara will look at that as well. You know, great fighters, I believe, you know, do what they do best is that, you know, sometimes plan A, B and C is not working. They go to their own devices and they learn how to win themselves. And that's what great fighters do, and that's what she is. She's a great fighter, you know. And if it's not working, she'll find a way of what is working for her and stick to it, you know. So I think she just needs not to be, you know, obviously stay away from the media as much as she can as well. Give a couple of interviews, but just, you know, mainly concentrate on getting her body back to what she wants it back to in relation to. She's after having 3 hard fights there as well. Mm-hmm. You know, it is getting, you know, turn stages as well. She's only got 3 days and she's fighting the Olympic final again. So again, it's one of those things. It's just, you know, recoup, start doing what you do best, you know, get your rest, get your food, make sure your weight's right, and things like that. But she cannot, you know, let it get ahead of her, you know. Like, you don't be thinking about the gold medal, thinking about winning the first round, think about winning the second round, and then maybe then you can start thinking about winning an Olympic gold medal, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Michael, hopefully yourself and Katie have some further company in your exclusive club on Sunday morning. Thanks a million for taking the call.
Thanks, guys. All the best.
Cheers. Michael Carruth there, of course, Irish gold medalist in 1992. So Kelly Harrington hoping to become the third Irish boxer ever to win a gold medal at the Olympic Games. Right, it is 9 minutes past eight on this Thursday morning. We've got a packed show still to come on OTB AM. We're going to be changing tack now over the next little while because we're going to hear from Ross Tucker on The Athletics. There'll be more reaction to Kelly Harrington's brilliant win this morning. And up next, we're talking about the Lions with Cian Tracy.
OTB
AM. You're welcome back. It is 10 minutes past 8. You're with us here on OTB AM. And if you've missed anything from the top of the show, we had 1992 Olympic gold medalist Michael Carruth with us. And OTB's Ronan Mullen was also running through Kelly Harrington's win this morning. You'll catch it back on the OTB AM podcast. Just search for OTB AM and click subscribe. From 5 o'clock today then, and every day through the Olympics, the OTB Sports Olympic show goes live across all of our social channels. We will bring you the biggest stories of the day, and we'll also be taking a look ahead to what's to come. And of course, there's one big event on Sunday, and that's what's to come. There'll be plenty of preview over the next couple of days. It's all in association with Indeed, who are proud to support Team Ireland at the Tokyo 2020 Games. Indeed believes the world works better when people are given every opportunity to unleash their true talents. Hashtag talent unleashed. Right, we are turning our attention now to the third and deciding test in the British and Irish Lions Tour to South Africa. Delighted to welcome Cian Tracy from the Irish Independent back to the show. Cian, good morning to you.
Hey, Owen, how are things?
Yeah, good. Let's kick things off here with Warren Gatland's comments this morning. Nothing overly explosive, but quite interesting. He's talking about the way the game has gone at the moment. He's referring to a lot of kicking, and that's where international rugby is at. It kind of feels like he's blaming the game in general for the fair on Saturday not being amazing.
Yeah, and really it takes two to tango, doesn't it? And yeah, I think the Lions were as much to blame as the Springboks were. I think that's one, been one of the most disappointing aspects of the tour, that the Lions have probably got sucked into playing South Africa at their own game. And you think about it back to the 2019 World Cup, they're playing the exact same style. I think the Lions were really going to have to come up with something different to try and beat them. Now, I know they won in that first test, but if you even think back to that first test, like how sluggish South Africa were, I mean, they had a couple of calls that went against their way. They could have had a couple of tries, you know, that could have went their way too. So really and truly, the series could be over. It's small margins. The Lions would probably argue that there were small margins in the second test as well. But South Africa haven't had two games under their belt now. There's huge momentum behind them. And you know, it's funny to kind of look at the reaction from, you know, South Africa compared to this side of the world, you know, with the fallout from the Rassie video and things like that. Like, South Africans, they don't care about the style of play. And really and truly, should they care about the style of play? Probably not. I mean, they're world champions. They could beat the Lions now as well. What they do is really, really effective. It always has been effective. For me, it's disappointing that the Lions haven't tried to think outside the box more. They're trying to go through the box rather than around them or over them. And that, to me, is the most frustrating thing, even in terms of like the fallout from last weekend, you know, in terms of like the Ches and Colby incident and the Faf de Klerk tackle. But I feel like people probably aren't remembering that the Lions like had a couple of decisions that really went their way as well, in terms of like, you think of Duan van der Merwe was very lucky when he put Peter Steph de Toy out of the game, and then when he tripped Colby as well. So I think there's incidents on both sides, and to go back to your original question, I think there are a pair at the minute here.
Yeah, and like as you say, it takes two to tango. And one of the other quotes from Gatland was, it's about territory and kicking in and putting kick pressure on, not playing too much rugby. Like, I mean, he's speaking as the British and Irish Lions head coach here. Like, we can't point a finger at South Africa for playing that way. I mean, pretty close to home, we experienced a lot of territory and a lot of kick pressure, which was quite successful for Ireland. And they weren't the only nation in the Six Nations to do that regularly over the last 5-10 years.
Yeah, we're probably used to seeing a similar game plan. But I think the biggest difference is, you think back to the 2018 when Ireland won the Grand Slam. Okay, fair enough, there was a lot of kicking in that game, but there was also so many intricate set piece moves. Like, you think back to the Grand Slam decider in Twickenham when CJ Stander scored that try, which for me is still probably one of the best tries an Ireland team has scored. But we haven't seen any of that sort of ingenuity. And I mean, obviously it's easy to point a finger at Gregor Townsend. I mean, I just don't think we have seen his influence at all on this tour. But I suppose I'd probably ask the question, is he being allowed to implement whatever strategy he wants? Because, I mean, this is really and truly a Warren game plan, what we're watching. I mean, I know it's a bit of a cliche, but you think of it like Warren ball. This is exactly what it is. But it didn't work for Wales at the World Cup. I mean, they came up short against South Africa in that semi-final. So to think, my reading of the situation is that from the outside looking in, he thought, okay, naturally enough, having a bigger player pool to play for, he can just enhance that same game plan and get the better of the box. And to me, I don't know, like he might pull it off on Saturday, but to me, it was a bit naive to think that that same game plan without tweaking it was going to work. And like I said, I just don't think we've seen anything of Gregor Townsend's influence. There's been no set piece moves. There's been very little creativity. Like you said, it's been pretty much like boot the ball up in the air and see if you can win the ball back. And I know that sounds very simplistic, but that's essentially what they're trying to do. And like last week, if you don't win the aerial battle and you're not winning the scrum battle either and the lineup battle, then you're in big trouble against the box.
The lack of a plan B has been something that's been really disappointing. Like, yeah, you're firmly obviously pointing the finger on one side of things to the coaches. Is there a case to be made here that the coaches are dealing with a group of players that maybe aren't at the level of the last Lions tour or the 2013 Lions tour?
Potentially, but I still think there's a lot of class in this squad. And like, I don't know, like players are playing to a particular game plan. I mean, I know the stat about Dan Biggar only had 3 passes in the game last weekend, which is just mad. But you can't tell me that an out half of Dan Biggar's quality is happy to have passed the ball 3 times in a game. You know, that just shows how much they're kicking off 9, and that just shows how much they're playing to the game plan. I mean, it is really disappointing. But when we were, I think I was on with you guys when we were talking about the squad when it was picked, like back in, what was it, April, May. And like the most exciting thing I think about the squad was he picked a lot of players, you know, that were good at the top of the ground, good on hard ground, you know, going to South Africa. You think of like Ty Byrne and Ian Henderson and Sam Simmons, these kind of guys. Like Billy Vunipola was left at home. And you're kind of wondering now, should Billy Vunipola, should he have been brought? Because really, the kind of game plan that they're playing, it's tailor-made for, you know, big ball carriers and to get over the gain line. Because I think that's something that the Lions have really lacked. They just haven't been winning the gain line. And they're lacking a bit of dynamism as well. I mean, you know, Jack Owen is playing his 3rd consecutive Lions test this weekend, and fair play to him. But for someone like him, I just don't think that the game plan is being tailored to his strengths. His strengths are getting on the ball in the wider channels, but He got a couple of chances in the first test, but in the second test, not at all. And to me, that points to the system isn't playing to someone like that. So I think that's one of the disappointing things as well, that there is quality in this squad, but I don't think they're playing to it. And I think even the team selection this weekend points to more of the same, really.
Yeah, Keen, that's what I was going to ask. There is 6 changes this weekend. We see Bundeyaki coming in to make his test cap. That's great news for him, and it's going to be really interesting to see how him and Robbie Henshaw get on. In your opinion, are they the correct changes?
Yeah, look, I think a lot of them make sense. I was probably surprised there wasn't a couple of more, to be honest. I think it's brilliant. I'm surprised that it's taken to the 3rd test, if I'm honest, to see Bundy, Aki and Robbie Henshaw be paired together. I think, you know, Bundy Aki's selection from the outset of the squad in general, you know, raised a few eyebrows, but I probably, in hindsight, wasn't really that surprised, because I think he's a classic Warren Gatland type of player. And, you know, I think he's a guy that we probably haven't seen the best of still for Ireland. I think there's still more to come from him. You know, you look back to the first test, the selection of Elliot Daly just didn't work at 13 at all. Chris Harris last week was okay. I mean, he's a pretty defensive-minded player anyway, so Bundeyaki, I think, can bring something different, because it means you're pushing Robbie Henshaw into 13. And to me, of the 3 centre partnerships that have played the 3 tests, this has the most balance. So I'm really excited to see how they do. I still think Bundeyaki is underappreciated by a lot of people in Ireland who aren't from Connacht, it has to be said, because Connacht get to see on a weekly basis how important he is for him. I think the changes in the back 3, were pretty obvious. I'm probably a little bit surprised maybe that Duane van der Merwe has kept his place, but I think Liam Williams and Josh Adams coming in makes a lot of sense. Addy Price at scrum half, it's interesting, it's tough for Conor Murray. It's been a roller coaster of a tour for Conor Murray. When you think back to it feels like ages ago now, but that when he was named captain when Alwyn Jones dislocated his shoulder, and then he doesn't start for the first test, and then he comes in and he starts for the second test, and now he's on the bench again. And I think when we saw Addy Price start the first test, I think, you know, there was probably a bit of excitement because it might have suggested that, you know, the Lions are going to try and play with a bit of tempo, try and get the ball to width. But that didn't happen at all in the first test. And actually, I thought Addy Price played pretty well, particularly in the second half. His box kicking was on the money. And I was probably a little bit surprised that he didn't keep his place for the second test. So I would be less kind of excited now about seeing Addy Price come into the team, because I think it's just going to be more of what we saw in the first test, which was plenty of box kicking. And then I suppose up front, the changes, yeah, like I think Wyn Jones was always going to start as soon as he was fit. Ken Owens, I think that's to kind of get a bit of solidity into the scrum. I think the Lions are lacking serious dynamism at hooker, and Ken Owens isn't going to really improve that. He should shore up the set piece, but again, that points to what Gatland is looking to do. For me, I think someone like Jamie George would have been worth a look. Far more dynamic, really solid at the set piece. And yeah, then the rest of the pack is the same. I was surprised maybe they didn't freshen up the back row in particular. I was on the paper review with Will on Sunday saying how frustrating it had been that Ty Byrne had, you know, only gotten a couple of really short cameos off the bench. And I was kind of expecting him to really push, maybe even for a start at six this week. And now he's not in the squad at all. So again, I think that points to more of how we're expected to see more of the same from the Lions this weekend.
You mentioned Bundiaki there, Keane, and the general maybe lack of the level of appreciation that he deserves outside of the Connacht support group. Do you think that there's a lack of appreciation within the Ireland coaching ticket as well?
I'm not sure about in the coaching ticket. I think like Gary Ringrose is such a classy player. He hasn't had the best kind of time with injury in the last year, so that's been a factor. But I think also since Robbie Henshaw has moved to Leinster, you know, he's playing all the time with Gary Ringrose. So when it comes to the Irish picture, I think it's much more attractive for the Irish coaches to go with Henshaw and Ringrose, because they're playing with each other all the time. Now, that's a pretty simplistic way of looking at it, but that does count for something. And I think that's maybe why Bundiaki hasn't featured as much. But to be fair, like even you think back to that, the 2018, the Grand Slam campaign, like Ringrose and Henshaw were both injured at various different points, and Bundiaki was kind of the one centre who featured in all five of Ireland's games. So he's been part of some pretty big wins. I think it's a big, big test for him this weekend. I mean, he's been put in there to bring physicality, but he's really got to keep it in check, because I think there are times where Bundiaki maybe lets the occasion get to the better of him because he's trying to put in the big hit. And I think Matthew Reynal is the ref this week as well, and I'm pretty sure he was the ref the last time Bundiaki played a test, which was for Ireland in the Six Nations when he got sent off against England for that high shot on Billy Vunipola. So I think he's just got to be mindful of that as well. But playing with Robbie Henshaw, I think will really help him, because you think back, like, this is a centre partnership that has been, you know, going since their Connacht days when they, you know, allegedly went after that famous stolen laptop. So these lads know how to do it, and the going gets tough.
On the Ali Price, Conor Murray way up then, like, I mean, you mentioned there was a lot of kicking off nine last week. Is there a sense that the Lions are replicating this whole scenario of being frustrated with Conor Murray for a tactic that maybe he's been told to execute?
I think that's the story of Conor Murray's career, to be honest with you. I think he becomes an easy person to criticise, because unfortunately a lot of people on social media, Twitter, whatever it is, just hate that style of play. But that's the way, the style of play that the coaches want to play. And I think he probably didn't have his best game last weekend. A couple of his box kicks weren't on the money, but yeah, it goes back to my original point. He's been asked to carry out the same game plan, and I think, you know, it's all well and good making like personnel changes to the team, but unless there's a tweak in mindset and sort of, you know, mentality of how they're looking to play, it doesn't matter who you have in there, because Ali Price and Conor Murray are very, very different scrum halves. But we saw it in the first test that Ali Price was being asked to carry out the same game plan that Conor Murray was being asked to play. So, yeah, it's like, you know, Jack Conan playing number eight. Like, if you're not playing to these guys' strengths, I think it becomes very, very difficult. And I wouldn't read too much into Ali Price starting scrum half that it means, you know, the Lions are suddenly going to play any differently. It's probably naive to think the Lions are going to play radically different within a week as well. I mean, I think, you know, they played some really nice, expansive rugby in the warm-up games, which I know the standard of opposition was really poor. But once it came to the test series, it reverted to type and it reverted to probably the game plan that Warren Gatland has relied upon for Wales over the last couple of years, which, to be fair, has brought him success. But like I said, it came unstuck in that World Cup semi-final. And I think this requires something different. I suppose even the selection of Finn Russell on the bench, you know, would suggest that. But I still think that that's going to be kind of an emergency option. I don't see kind of Finn Russell coming on. I think if Dan Biggar, touch wood, like, you wouldn't wish injury on anyone, but if he was to get injured early on and Finn Russell comes on, I think then it actually could be brilliant for the game itself, because it could really open up and we might see a lot of different things. Because, you know, you asked about Ali Price, like, the Box have made an enforced change of scrum half as well. And Cobus Brynach coming in for Faf de Klerk. I mean, that kind of changes the dynamic of what they're able to do as well, because, like, Brynach is probably a similar kind of change to the Lions taking Conor Murray out, in that Faf de Klerk is a far stronger box kicker than Brynach. Brynach is also right-footed. Faf de Klerk is left-footed. That does make a difference as well when you think about the number of box kicks that they're going to put up and, you know, being used to chasing off a left-footed kicker. But Brynach offers something a little bit different as well. He's a major threat, sniping threat around the edge of the fringes. So that could, you know, in terms of, like, the neutrals wanting to see a better game, I still think the Box are going to play the same game plan, but Brynach has a little bit more of an X factor around the fringes than Faf de Klerk has.
And the Springboks, they have the momentum now. You know, they look like they're getting that match sharpness back. How important is it, I suppose, for the attack? I know you mentioned it there, Keane, for them to vary that, because, as you said, they're almost running straight at them and trying to go through them.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, they're running into probably the best defence in the world, probably run by now the best defensive coach, Jack Nienaber, who is the head coach now. And I think he's probably someone that hasn't gotten a lot of the credit, because the Rassie Erasmus show has dominated the agenda over the last couple of weeks. But, you know, this is his first head coach role. And that maybe might have gone under the radar, because, like, you talk to any of the Munster players who played under Nienaber and Erasmus, and, like, most of them will tell you that they absolutely loved playing for these two guys. And I know, like, the Erasmus video last week, you know, that deflected a lot of the tension away. And I think all the while it allowed kind of Nienaber to get on with the job. And obviously Rassie is still doing a huge amount of coaching, but Nienaber is, like, they really play the good cop, bad cop role really well. And that goes back to their Munster days. And even when Rassie left Munster in 2018, I think it was, Munster, as far as I'm aware, really wanted Nienaber to stay as head coach. And he was obviously the defence coach at the time. So this guy has been kind of, you know, primed for the main role for a while. So his defensive system that he has implemented at the Box is just, it's so, so tough to break down. But I think, like, they're missing, like I mentioned, Faf de Klerk, Peter Steph de Toy as well. And they've had to change around the shakeup of their back five in the pack. And I think that will make a difference. I think the Lions are going to really have to try and find a way to go after that. I think Franco Mostert moving to the back row, he was outstanding last weekend. And Lou De Jager coming off the bench was probably, like, you know, your classic game changer. And actually really helped, I think, reignite the bomb squad, because I thought last week going into the game that was an area the Lions could have got after him. But, I mean, as well as Mostert played, he is an out-and-out lock. So I think the Lions are going to try and have to find a way to get at him. But, I mean, on paper, a Springbok team without Faf de Klerk and without Peter Steph de Toy is not as strong as it was last week. And the knock-on effect of that is the bench isn't as strong. So, like I said, the Box have gone back to a 5-3 split, which is something they really, really don't want to do. They didn't want it. They did it in the first test, and we saw what happened then. They had absolutely no impact off the bench. Now, the reason they went for it in the first test was Andre Pollard and Matt Pimpy had only just recovered from COVID, so they felt like they had to have the third back on the bench, which made sense. But this week, their hand, I think, is more forced by the fact that they just don't have the quality of forwards of loose forwards to bring off the bench. So is it Quagga Smith and Marco van Staden are the two kind of guys they're going to be looking to? The front row is different. I mean, the front row is outstanding that they'll bring, but I think that they're not as strong on the bench this week. But the question is, are the Lions good enough to take advantage of that? And I think that's the bigger question hanging over this week.
And it's a question not only of the players but of the coaching staff as well. Kian, great stuff this morning. Thanks a million for taking the call.
Cheers, guys.
Cheers. Kian Tracy there of the Irish Independent on the line. It is 8:31 on this Thursday morning, and the football pod with Paddy and Andy, I was going to say the football pad with Paddy and Andy, our brand new Gaelic football podcast is the place to be ahead of the All-Ireland semi-finals. Episode 13 is up and out. Go check it out and subscribe to the podcast. And the fighting talk between Paddy Andrews and Andy Moran has already begun ahead of Dublin versus Mayo.
The way you started out with Paddy and the first bit of fighting talk we'll have for, I think Dublin have slipped, but they can't. If you lose Jim Gavin, you lose Declan Darcy, Jason Sherlock, if you're back from him, you've slipped already. The boys might be good, but to be as good as them straight away in year two, I think it's huge. I don't think Dublin won the All-Ireland this year.
Jesus, he's straight in here.
I don't think they will. I think I said near the doors, I think Kerry will win all Ireland. So I think Dublin have slipped. Now, how much they've come back to the pack is there to see. Now, you've mentioned, now you're on about players. I've often mentioned Bernard on this pod. To me, he was the best forward of my generation of our, when I played, he was the best forward. I don't think there was anyone better than him. That's my view. I've had many rows about himself and Gooch over the years. But for my opinion, he was the best forward. He was the best Dublin forward. He was the one that caused us most damage. He was just an outstanding player. So you start losing right from Alan Brogan in 15 and it starts moving. Of course you've slipped. You've lost Cluxton, who's been the best goalkeeper. He's the most successful captain that has ever played the game of Gaelic football. You lose him. That's a slippage. It might mean a huge slippage, but it's a slippage. Because of his age, it might be a huge slip. So if Dublin lose one or two through something happens to them in their main versus B games or them in those games, they have a huge chance here, lads. Let's not dress this up. It's not... Mayo have had an unbelievably successful season. No matter what happens against Dublin, they're going into this game with zero pressure, with James Horne absolutely fulfilling expectation since Killian O'Connor went down against Clare. Got us promoted, won a Connacht Championship, and have got a free shot, I would say. I think we got a free shot at Dublin last year in the All-Ireland final, and I think we've another free shot at them in the semi-final. No, I probably think Kerry would still win the All-Ireland, but that's what we've got, and it's huge. And how do we prepare for that in 12 days? It's all about, for me, it's all about the matchups. It's all about what you do in the matchups for Mayo.
Very interesting stuff there from Andy Moore. Is it a free shot for Mayo? Can you get two free shots in a row at the stage? Maybe you can. Maybe the Killian O'Connor thing has completely changed their expectations for the season, and they've done a great job so far. So that's the Paddy and Andy football pod. It's available now. It's available first on the OTB Sports app, I should say, every single week. And it's out early in the week, reacting to the previous weekend's action. Also, the Bernard Brogan Gooch line started a war on Twitter last night, which I actually did not see. I would happily weigh in on that. Personally, and I think Andy Moran is just completely wrong in that one. But sure, look, each to their own in the Bernard Brogan versus Gooch thing. We do want to chat, Aisling, about that evening that this game is going to take place, because the scramble for tickets is obviously going to be pretty incredible over the course of the next week. But at least you're going to get two for the price of one. You're going to get Dublin versus Mayo in the women's football as well. So this is going to be a cracking night, because those two teams have obviously been in and around the All-Ireland challengers for the last few years. Dublin have been the All-Ireland winners for the last few years. So it's a brilliant curtain raiser, to say the least.
Oh, absolutely, Owen. And that's exactly where the girls want to be, you know, at a doubleheader in Croke Park with the men's teams. It's unbelievable. It's definitely things that they dream of getting to do, to be honest, you know, and now they're getting to do it. So that's brilliant. I suppose for Mayo, I sort of wondered where they were this year. I wasn't sure they were going to do much, to be honest. They didn't seem like they were on form, but their win against Galway last week, they had a 4-point win, and that's a massive rivalry there, you know. So it was brilliant to see them get that. Sarah Rowe was back in form. She got 3 points. It was great to see that. And Shane McCaffrey as well. She got 1-2. So, yeah, it was a brilliant game. But against the Dubs, they're coming up against the All-Ireland champions. They, just like the men's team, they know how to win. You know, even when they go down, they know exactly how to stay calm and come back and get over the line. And I don't think this will be any different. I think it's a tough task for Mayo. I really do. But a massive occasion for them. And yeah, brilliant to see it in Croke Park.
I want to chat about the other side of the draw, because you reckon this could be a Mayo or Dublin versus Meath final.
Yes. Yes, that's it, Owen. I think this is massive. Like, for me to be in an All-Ireland semi-final is just incredible in their first year in senior. You know, it's just madness. And they came up against Armagh last week, and I think Armagh were heavily tipped favourites going in. Meath were loving that. They were loving that they were underdogs. And yeah, they came out on top there. And just the way Andy was speaking there on matchups, that was a big thing in this game. We seen who was going to pick up Amy Macken was a big question. I did a podcast a few days before. That was the main question everyone wants to know, even amongst friends and like our club mates. That's what we were asking. And I actually have a club mate, Katie New, on the team. And we were talking the 2 days before, and I asked her who's going to pick her up, and she wasn't giving much away. And she actually ended up picking her up. So she kept it quiet. And she did some job on her as well. But look, Amy still got 1-6 in the end. You know, I think what it came down to in that game was, you know, they really pushed Armagh out to take their long range shots. And we seen Amy's well able to do that. So she kept them ticking away. But it just wasn't enough. She seemed to be their only really outlet. And yeah, Meath got over the line. So they're going to be in an All-Ireland semi-final against Cork. They've met Cork before in the first round of the championship, and they lost by 2 points. Again, I think Meath would be delighted going in underdogs for that. They've improved somewhat since then. You know, they've championship games under their belt. So I think this is going to be massive. And I do, if I was going to call it, I would say I would see a Meath-Dublin final. And I know that's big to call it, but I genuinely think this is what we're going to see.
This is kind of like Nottingham Forest stuff coming up and then actually dominating the game immediately. The level of prediction, Aisling, but it's, as you said, the form line is there. Beating Armagh last week is not something that anybody would have seen, obviously, with the attacking talent that Armagh have. And then you've pointed to the 2-point defeat to Cork, so they're at the same level. And it is extraordinary that they are All-Ireland Intermediate champions, and that is the level that they were at last year. And it's interesting, since we just come off the football pod, I may as well give Andy Moran credit for actually a really good shout that he had a few weeks ago when the idea of championship structures was being spoken about. And the one kind of thing that really, I guess, sticks in the craw of a lot of people when it comes to the Tailteann Cup or any sort of junior competition in men's football is that, will people actually care about it? And Andy made the point that actually, if you look at the women's game, you look at someone like Meath last year and the celebrations when they won the Intermediate Championship, and we see it all the time with Intermediate and Junior level in the women's football. And then on top of that, we see the progression that a team like Meath have made this year. Something is going right in the way that competition is set up.
Absolutely. You need something to play for. You know, you put a serious amount of effort and work in, and obviously to keep the talent coming through in each county as well. You need to see, a possibility, an end goal. And that's what you see with the women's game. You have that junior, intermediate, senior. And for me, we were senior. I was actually on the team when we were graded to intermediate. And that was massive. And I remember being in that dressing room at the start of the year, and everyone was asking the question. And there was a lot of the girls were absolutely against it. We're a senior team. Why would we not want to play at senior level? And then you had the other side of the dressing room, which was saying, but look, girls, we're going out against Cork here, and we're getting trashed. You know, we're not even putting up a fight. And that's just being realistic about it. So you had that balance there in the dressing room, but overall everyone came together and said, what's best here for ladies football in Meath? And we said, yes, it is to regrade.
And was it an even split in the dressing room? Were there some hard conversations had around that debate?
Oh yeah, absolutely. There was a lot of girls that didn't want to, you know, a lot of girls see it as, we're playing senior, we're at the top level, this is where we need to be, this is where we want to be. You know, we play to play at the top level, and that's where they wanted to stay. But I think if you looked at the long-term goal, and they did in the end, they seen that, look, if we look at the long-term goal here of wanting to win medals, wanting to win championships, this is what we need to do. And inevitably, look at what's happened. Like, they've really seen some serious growth. And the first few years of intermediate was so tough. The intermediate championship is no joke. You know, it's very, very tough. And everybody says it's hard to get out of. So we had some tough years. But once we finally did, you know, you've seen the girls and you see what they're doing now. And they've gone on to win it. And now, 1 year on, they're in an All-Ireland semi. So as you said, Owen, it does work. That system works.
Like, because it's a really interesting one, and I'm not sure what the answer is on a whole multitude of things and on a whole different level of competition structure and all that. But so say, for example, if your Meath team hadn't been regraded and you stayed at senior level and competing for the All-Ireland, do you think you would still be as close to Dublin now as this current team is, or it is actually dropping down and letting Dublin push the boat out, letting them win as many All-Irelands as they want, and me dropping down and winning their intermediate All-Irelands, is that actually the only way you can close that gap?
God, I don't know if it's the only way to close it, but I suppose talking from Meath and their experience in the last few years, I think those younger girls, like they were very successful with minor coming through, and they'd won All-Irelands there, and you were always going to get those girls up, I suppose. But those girls seen that there was a change. They seen that Meath was starting to win games, because there was a point there, Owen, where we weren't winning any games. Like, we, you know, and that does have a knock-on effect. So, you know, there's young girls seeing that and they go, ah, sure, look, you know, we'll concentrate on something else here. But we started to win games. I remember us winning our first Leinster, and that was massive in the county. And from then on, you know, they went the next year, they got one step close, and then they won the All-Ireland then. So, yeah, I do think that we wouldn't be at this stage unless we hadn't regraded, because, you know, we needed to put that groundwork in. We needed to go back to almost, you know, the start, to regroup. There was new management in, and it was just a fresh start. And I do believe that the regrading was the best thing that Meath football could have done. And yeah, that's why we're seeing this growth. And yeah, they're going to be in an All-Ireland semi-final.
It'd be really, really interesting. And it's a fascinating case study, especially if they do manage to get the job done against Cork next week. On Dublin, do you think they're very much still the team to beat? And how far ahead of the pack do you think they are?
Yeah, they're definitely the team to beat. I think Mayo have a seriously tough task there to go up against them and to get over the line. I think Dublin are beatable, though, you know, sort of like the men. They're coming back to the pack. They're definitely back in the pack. And I don't think that they're unbeatable or unstoppable in any way. So I do think it's going to be an interesting year. I think it's a wide open. I don't think they're clear favourites, and that's great. You know, that's what you want to see in a senior championship. So yeah, I do think it's wide open. We've seen Carla Rowe last week as well. She's just immense, and just the type of football she's playing. So, you know, if everybody's on form, they are hard to stop. But I definitely think they're coming back to the pack, and they can be bet. And I do think that they can be stopped this year, and it just remains to be seen if they're in the final, who will be with them.
Absolutely, and we will preview those games with you, Aisling, next week properly, because it's going to be a great weekend of football in men's football and in women's football on Saturday and Sunday week. Rob, we wanted to turn our attention back to the Olympic Games this morning, because there's been a number of really interesting stories, especially on the track over the past couple of days. And I'm delighted to welcome Professor Ross Tucker, who you'll know from a multitude of different things, including the Real Science of Sport podcast, which is absolutely worth your time. It's absolutely brilliant. Is with us. Ross, great to talk to you. How are you keeping?
Yeah, good, thanks. How are you guys? It's been a long time since we spoke, so I'm glad to be back on.
A long time. Let's get into everything that we've missed, from the Tour de France to the Olympics to all the... No, we won't. We'll just focus on the Olympic Games and just the last couple of days, if that's all right. Let's start with this fast track, Ross. Have fast tracks not always been a thing, and have people not always spoken about fast tracks?
Yes, I remember when I was still a kid watching the Olympics in Atlanta, they spoke about the track being built for the sprinters because they want world records on the big stage. And the distance runners used to complain because they were so hard, basically like slabs of concrete. What seems to be different, and I mean, maybe this is just that I haven't seen it in the past, is that the conversation now, they're talking about this one being more like a trampoline. I've seen a few athletes say that it's more trampoline-like. One of them said it's like running on air, and the distance athletes haven't complained. So it feels to me like the evolution of the material that goes into making the track has changed. So where before fast meant hard, now fast means elastic and bouncy. And so not unlike what's happened to shoes, the evolution has been in how cushioned but springy can you make the ground? And that seems to be the difference here. So whether it's just marketing or real, I don't know. It feels real to me.
Yeah, because that's kind of like the key question here, is just to give people the quotes from the track designer. He said that the track is very thin, 14 millimeters, but we have added a new element, these rubber granules. He said in the lower layer of the track is this hexagonal design that creates these small pockets of air that not only provide shock absorption, but give some energy return at the same time, a trampoline effect. But can you not have too much of a trampoline effect, Ross? Is this essentially one of the reasons why we're seeing the hurdlers in particular having a particular good time of it?
Yeah, it could be. Just incidentally, what you read there would not be out of place in the marketing materials for a running shoe. So they are very much the same because, you know, and it was probably 5 or 6 years ago that they started to take these new rubberized materials and put them into midsoles, and it's inevitably found its way into the ground. I spoke with an elite coach the other day. I asked him for his thoughts on it, and he said something interesting, is that when you walk on it, you can already feel that there's something different. But he said some athletes feel that and others don't. So it might be that there's something related to the mechanics where when you're trying to sprint, the objective is you have to apply as much force to the ground as possible. And that force is obviously either vertical and then horizontal. I wonder whether some athletes that apply more vertical force might get more joy from the surface than others. And maybe hurdlers get so much because they're actually jumping 10 times a race, and it helps keep the stride pattern appropriate, especially in the 400, because as you might know, that's the big challenge in the last 150 meters is actually reaching the next hurdle. And that seems to be offset by the bounciness of the surface. Incidentally, if you make it too trampoline-like, then it becomes negative because then the athlete like sinks into it and loses all the energy. So it has to be very stiff but bouncy. So that's a tricky balance. It seems they found it though.
Yeah, it definitely seems that way. And from what you're saying there, it seems to me that the reaction to this could be maybe a focus on technique with that specific surface to ensure that you are getting as big a benefit as possible off that surface.
Yeah, possibly. Although the coach, because I asked him, does it make a difference on the contact time with the ground? Does it make a difference to the stride length by propelling the athlete forward? And he says he actually doesn't know. So
right.
I'm not sure they know enough to leverage it into some sort of deliberate advantage. I think everyone's just enjoying the speed that it gives them.
On the shoes then, I'm interested in why Carsten Warholm is not a hypocrite here, because after his 400 meter hurdles, he spoke about Rye Benjamin spikes and obviously Nike Super spikes, who we've spoken about quite a bit on the show. He called them BS. He said he has those things in his shoes, which I hate. And then talking about his own shoes, which he made in conjunction with Mercedes and Puma, he says, we have the carbon plate. We have tried to make it as thin as possible because that is the way I would like to do it. Of course, technology will always be there, but I also want to keep it down to a level where we can compare results, because that is important. Like, I guess we got to take Warholm's word for it to a certain degree, but why are his shoes more acceptable than Rye Benjamin spikes?
Beats me. I saw the same quote and I wondered that when I saw that they developed it with McLaren. And I think it depends on what you think is making the difference in the shoe, you know, because track spikes have always had a stiff carbon plate in them, but we've never seen those carbon fiber plates or the integration of the carbon fiber with the midsole, the elastic midsole material, produce results like we have now. So Warholm's obviously of the school of thought that it's the midsole, because that's the Nike spike, it's called the Viperfly. I don't know if you've seen pictures of it. It's got this sort of spring-mounted thing under the forefoot, which looks ridiculous, and which Nike claim compresses, much like you read about the track. It compresses, stores energy, and then releases it back. He doesn't have that, so he obviously believes that's the difference. I would argue that the curvature of the carbon plate is probably making the difference, together with the thickness of the midsole. So, yeah, he's not running in 2018 shoes when he runs that world record, so he knows that it makes a difference to him as well.
And speaking on those world records, is it unfair to athletes that have gone before? You know, we heard you saying both that it's he said basically that if the shoes start to get too fast, then that's unfair, that you have a problem if the equipment starts to make that leap faster than they actually are. You know, that's what we don't want to see.
Yeah, I'm a purist. Some would say that means old-fashioned in that sense. But for me, the value in athletics is the ease with which we can compare one generation to the previous one. Times mean something, and I think the shoes have distorted that meaning. So we can't say for sure that athlete A is half a second faster than athlete B, because we know that half that half a second might be a contribution of the shoes and the other half might be the track. So it destabilizes our ability to assess performances. I suppose, on the other hand, you'd say an athlete who's retired doesn't really have a right to fairness. I mean, Usain Bolt watching the Olympics on his couch is basically looking after his own legacy. And that's eventually going to change anyway. Records will be broken, whether they're broken 10 years too soon, thanks to tech, maybe one would argue is irrelevant. I always think the bigger concern is there fairness right now? And that's debatable when it comes to the shoes. So, yeah, I guess whether you're a Luddite or a technologically advanced person, you'll differ on that one.
What about physiologically then, Ross? Is there something that you are seeing over the course of the last week that would not concern you, but would certainly cause you to ask questions about how human evolution has all of a sudden gone from whatever the evolution of man all of a sudden on a vertical axis, and then we're starting to see, I don't know, that the man get bigger and bigger and bigger?
Yeah, I mean, it feels like humans have made a breakthrough in the last sort of 18 months, performing at a level that previous versions didn't do. That might be biased. I mean, that could just be confirmation bias, because I'm looking at Elaine Thompson and Shelly-Ann Fraser-Pryce and the 400 hurdlers and saying, oh, look at this. But meanwhile, the men's 100 maybe has never been weaker. So the 400 is also probably not going to be as good as it was 5 years ago. So why one event and not the other? Why not all the events? So there's a lot of, call it noise, that affects our ability to interpret this. It would be quite an interesting exercise to really sit down and say, right, what is the 10th best athlete, the 50th best athlete, the average of the top 50? What are they doing now compared to 2-3 years ago? And of course, I guess where you're going with this is that with COVID and lockdown and the sort of global cessation of anti-doping, there's been no disincentive for athletes to dope over the last 12, 18 months. I mean, I think in the quarter that the lockdown was the worst, so now we're going back to March, April, May last year, I saw stats that many countries in Europe had not conducted a single test in that three-month period. I think the UK anti-doping conducted 5% of its normal testing. Now, the authorities, anti-doping authorities, are always telling us that we can trust the performances because the testing out of competition keeps the athletes clean. Well, if that's true, then the reverse must also be true. So I think there is reason to doubt what we see.
Have you begun to reconsider how quickly the rate of world records that are being broken, or the magnitude with which world records are being broken, have you begun to reconsider if that'll actually start to level off at a sooner rate than you thought, or if we're going to see world records continue to be broken for years and years and years to come?
Well, I thought it had leveled off. I mean, you looked at the world record books 4 or 5 years ago, and you had these two batches. You had all the sprint performances, which were Bolt from the late 2000s, and then you had all the distance records, which went back to the 1990s and early 2000s. And then on the women's side, of course, you go even further back, because the steroid hormones of the 70s and 80s moved women into a place that no natural female can get to. So it looked like they'd already stagnated, and now all of a sudden we've seen them chop down in the middle distances. We've seen them cut down in the long distances. Shoes, is it are the shoes confounding the analysis, or is it all the shoes? No one knows. So it's quite an unstable time. And I mean, I'd hate to predict, but if I say now, it's hard to see it continuing. Then by 2024, it'll have continued, and it will all look foolish, you know. So who knows?
Yeah. And then what about on a purely... So obviously there's a ton of variables involved there. Technology, anti-doping, they're two of the big ones. But what about on a purely physiological level, Ross? Is there still room for evolution, I guess?
Not a great deal. The only way you could see that is if there was some sort of breakthrough or the emergence of a new population. So I think you could go back to the sort of 70s, 80s, and at that stage, sport wasn't truly global. Now sport is truly global. So it's very difficult to imagine that there is a group of humans who have some genetic advantage, whether it's for sprinting or distance running, who haven't yet been exposed, identified, and then pushed through the system to run at the Olympic Games. I mean, I saw this morning Burkina Faso became the 100th country to win a medal in track and field at the Olympic Games. So this is a this is now a properly global sport. And I can't imagine that there's anything there, you know, like the emergence of a new group of people. So then you've got to say, well, can we do things that much better? My impression is that things like sports science and medicine haven't gotten 2% better in the last 20 years. They get 0.1% better. And we're actually sometimes revisiting things that were out of fashion 20 years ago. So no, I can't think that anything other than tech is going to propel humans faster.
Maybe if we send Dave Brailsford to Burkina Faso and tell him about marginal gains, we might actually see the next big breakthrough, Ross. One other thing we want to chat about, because it's a really fascinating story, are the Namibian sprinters. And Christine Mboma, the 18-year-old sprinter from Namibia, who won a silver medal in the women's 200 metres this week, so herself, and Beatrice Masilingi, also from Namibia, they're not allowed to run in the 400 metres, which is their better distance. They are women with differences in sex development, DSD, as people will be more, as it will be more commonly known to people. They can't compete between 400 metres and a mile unless they've taken medicine to lower their testosterone. So just for people who might be coming to this a little bit fresh, Ross, could you remind us of the background as to why they can run the 200 but not the 400?
Yeah, what a convoluted story. Like, I mean, if aliens landed on Earth and saw this, they'd say this is ridiculous. How can you be legal on a Saturday because you're running a 200 and illegal on a Sunday because you're running the 4? Surely whatever gives you the advantage in the one event is still there for the other because they're so similar. But the way that it developed is that back in 2016, the sport had a policy for DSDs that covered all the events. And that policy was challenged by an Indian sprinter called Duti Chand, who ran in the 200 in Tokyo. I saw on television the other day. And the court case basically ruled in her favor, but they said to World Athletics that we understand why you have this policy, we get it, but what you need is evidence to support it. So go away, you've got 2 years, and come back to us with evidence. And so off they went, and they produced what really can only be described as very average evidence. They looked for relationships between testosterone and performance at the World Athletics Championships over 2 years, two cycles. And they were only able to find that relationship in the 400 and the 800. In other words, in those two events only, women with high testosterone had a performance advantage compared to women with lowest testosterone. And so when they then came back to the courts to revise their policy, they were constrained because they couldn't cover all the events. They could only cover the events for which they had evidence, poor evidence. And so they ended up in this very clumsy situation where, and I mean, I was at the Court of Arbitration hearing, and their theoretical argument was beautiful. It was so strong, you know, this idea that testosterone gives an unfair biological advantage to people who benefit from it, males, in other words. And if you allow that confounder, androgens, to enter women's sport, then it distorts integrity and fairness for women, and so therefore women's sport needs to be closed off. I mean, it was a tremendous argument, but then the evidence in support of it was so poor that they couldn't apply this theory to everything. So they ended up capturing the 4 and the 8. They added the 15 because Caster Semenya was running it. And so they said, well, a lot of 800 meter runners also do the 15, but they didn't go the other way. I mean, they should have said that a lot of 400 runners also do the 2, but they didn't. So that loophole allows the Namibians to just say, fine, we'll go win medals in the 200.
And that's a really interesting point you make about Semenya there, that I think you actually did you testify on behalf of Semenya in that hearing because of in the CAS hearing because of the fact that the evidence in your opinion was so shaky. Like it certainly seems to me that regardless of your viewpoint on this, when it came to Semenya, she was targeted because she was winning, which is not the way you can work something like this.
No, exactly. Like, I mean, and that's the same situation they're going to be in now if they add the 200. And it was almost by design, because when they went away to find their evidence as per the court instruction, the study they did, as I mentioned, they just looked for which events or could they find where testosterone predicted performance. And of course, they found it in the events where the athletes with the high testosterone were. So Semenya was there. They had a couple other 800 meter runners. And so they basically set up, which was a circular argument. So I don't think, I mean, I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt here, but I don't think they targeted Semenya, but they certainly designed a process that was going to isolate and identify her for regulation. So now, I mean, I don't know if you've got this game where you go to the fairground and you hit the crocodile as it pops its head out the hole. That's what they're playing now, because now you're going to have these. And this Mboma, who won silver in the 200, her first 100 meters is so poor that if she could fix that, she'd win the gold and she could probably break the world record. So they're going to be faced with the same thing. And then they're going to add the 200 and people will say, well, you just don't want these black African women to win. That's what's going to
happen. Yeah. Where does it leave these athletes if you do add the 200? They just stop competing, some of the greatest athletes that we've seen.
Sorry, I missed the first part of that.
Just that if we add the 200, then where does it leave these athletes? You know, do we just stop seeing these athletes competing, like some of the best athletes we've seen?
Yeah, I mean, if you add the 200, then they've got to go to the 100, or they'll run the 5,000. Okay, they're not going to go up there. But, I mean, one of the other DSD athletes, Francine Nyansaba, went up. She ran the 5,000. So, yeah, they've created this weird paradox that allows athletes to just kind of move around and try and escape the regulations. And again, I mean, I testified at the case about the evidence, but the principle is sound. You have to protect women's sport against the male biological advantages, but the way it's been done is just so damaging to the person who's covered by it. It's a real shame.
You mentioned there about Mboma's run, and if she managed to get the first 100 nailed, she would have been a gold medalist winner. And thankfully, we've got Seb Coe, who's given his reaction to the race. He says, it was pretty observable that the last 30 or 40 metres were impactful. And actually, I think that vindicated the decision about the 400 metres. If you were finishing a 200 like that, you extend the runway. That in a way supports the judgment that was made. I presume that went down very well in the scientist community, Ross.
Oh, that I saw that quote. I mean, it's you'll always manage to find a way to distort something into something else. I mean, for that is called like silver lining thinking, if you've ever seen it, you know, or glass half full. Crazy theory. I mean, yeah. Honestly, I'm speechless to even respond to it. It's just a bizarre defense that he's offering. I mean, truth is, if she improves her start, this was her first major competition at 200. I think she came in a second slower than she ended up running three races later. So by the end of the season, she'll be winning, and by next year, she might be breaking the record. So. Then what would you say then?
I want to go back to what Aisling said there, because we're kind of tight on time, and it's a really interesting question about where that leaves athletes in these positions. So more from Seb Coe, he kind of spoke about the option of an open category in the future, a restricted biological female category. He says, I don't think that's where most of my council are at the moment, but this is a debate. I've heard coaches and people who are interested in the sport and more broadly from the sport have discussed that. Is that a realistic avenue at some point in the future, Ross?
It's theoretical in nature. It's very difficult to implement in real life. I mean, when World Rugby sat down to discuss its transgender policy, we ended at the same point where we said, all right, men's rugby is the open category. Anyone can play it. But we need to have adjacent to men's rugby, we need to have a closed category. And what are we closing it against? The biological effects of testosterone. So then sport changes from having men's and women's to having open and then protected. But the thing is, ultimately, it's just renaming the same category. And so when that was presented and discussed with the transgender community, they rejected it on that basis. And that's why it'll probably not work there either. But in theory, that's what men's and women's sports categories do. It's just putting a different name to them and then hoping to convince people that somehow that makes it palatable to those who don't want it.
There may be a very short answer to this question, Ross, but Is there a world in which you can see an organisation like World Athletics finding some sort of satisfying answer to the debate between inclusion and diversity and fairness?
If satisfying means that both sides are happy, then absolutely not, unfortunately. If satisfying means that the majority are happy, then of course. And if satisfying means that the minority is happy, then they can do it. But the point is that they have to choose. You know, the sports are going to have to make a decision around which one they value. Do they value the fairness or do they value inclusion? Because at the moment, I can't see that there's a way to achieve both at the same time.
And is your sense that inclusion is higher up on the priority list for World Athletics specifically at the moment? Or have they fudged it so badly at this point that it's muddied the waters where you don't actually know which is the higher priority?
No, I think their priority at the moment is fairness, because that's why they've taken the approach that they did in the Semenya thing, and they did do it badly, to be fair, or to be honest about it. The debate really is whether the fix, you know, they ask these athletes, you mentioned it, they ask these athletes to lower their testosterone levels and then they can compete. They do the same thing with trans women. So they're trying to facilitate inclusion and fairness at the same time. There's no evidence that fix works. And so the ball is back in their court now, and it's back in the IOC's court to say, all right, we had this idea and it was going to work for fairness and inclusion. It clearly doesn't. So now, again, we have to choose. And then I suspect that they will be pressurized into weighting inclusion more than fairness. But that remains to be seen.
It's really interesting. We could obviously go on for hours here, and I would encourage people to go to the Real Science of Sport podcast and listen to Ross talk about it for a more in-depth conversation about it, for sure. Before I let you go, Ross, I mean, your beloved Springboks this weekend, are they going to get the job done?
Yeah, I think so. I think the momentum is with the team. The loss of three players, especially Fafta Clark, is a big deal. I think that'll compromise defensively what we are able to do, but I suspect that we will get it done.
Come for the athletics analysis, stay for the rugby prediction. Professor Ross Tucker, thanks a million.
Thanks, guys. Ciao.
Cheers. And as I say, you can follow him at Science of Sport on Twitter as well. Just to let you know what's coming up on OTB Sports Radio throughout the day, from 1 o'clock we'll have Jerry Eisenberg talking Muhammad Ali. 3 o'clock then is the History of Sport with Paul Rouse. And then from 4 o'clock is a retro panel on sport and Irish identity. From 5 o'clock then, as it is the case every single day during the Olympics, is the Olympic show, with thanks to Indeed. And then from 6 o'clock, OTB Gold with Declan Murphy talking about his book Centaur. And then at 7 o'clock, Off the Ball is live on the OTB Sports Radio and on your radios tonight. We're checking in with Ross and Harry Byrne before 9:30 this morning on OTB AM. And up next, we're hearing the latest from the Olympics with Neil Tracy.
OTB AM.
Welcome back. It is 9:09 on this Thursday morning. This is OTB AM. It is Owen and Aisling O'Reilly with you right the way through until 10 o'clock this morning. Neil Tracy is here to bring us up to speed on another medal. Well, a medal of a different colour this morning for Team Ireland.
Yeah, certainly is, Owen. As we know by now, boxer Kelly Harrington will be looking to follow Michael Carruth and Katie Taylor this Sunday and become Ireland's just third ever boxing gold medalist at the Olympic Games. She booked her place in the final with a split decision victory against Sudipan Sisondi this morning. The 31-year-old will now take on Beatriz Ferreira of Brazil in the gold medal bout in what's going to be a meeting of the 2018 and 29 world champions. Meanwhile, another good day as well for Natalia Coyle, because the three-time Olympian now is in third place overall after the fencing section of the modern pentathlon this morning. The Meath woman picked up 238 points across her 17 matches this morning, winning 7 of her final 8 matches, and the remaining rounds of the modern pentathlon will all take place tomorrow. Also a pretty good day as well for Stephanie Meadow and Leona Maguire on the golf course, because they've boosted their chances of a medal. They're both 4 under par and tied for 11th place after 2 rounds in Tokyo. Meadow had a 5 under par round of 66 today, with Maguire signing off for a round of 67. World number one Nelly Korda double bogeyed the last, but she has a 4-shot lead on 13 under. Now, it remains to be seen if this is going to be a 3-round or a 4-round competition. The organisers put out an update this morning saying that they are prepared to play the final round on Sunday rather than Saturday because there's a large tropical storm incoming. But they did say if they are unable to complete the final round by Sunday, then it would be reduced to a 54-hole competition. So, unfortunately, not a huge amount of clarity as to how long the competition is going to be. Then also in Olympic news, Tanya Watson narrowly missed out on a place in the 10-metre platform diving final. The 19-year-old was 15th in her semi-final, where the top 12 advanced to the medal places. Andrew Coscarin is in action in the 1500 metres semi-finals at lunchtime today, while at the moment Mark Downey is in 17th place overall in the Omnium after two of the four stages, while David Kenny is in the early stages of the 20-kilometre walk. And just a few other soccer stories to bring you. Dundalk manager Vinnie Perth says his side are capable of upsetting Vitesse Arnhem in the third round of qualifying in the Europa Conference League this evening. They're in the Netherlands for the first leg of that tie this evening. Michael Duffy is back for Dundalk. A 6 p.m. kickoff. Duffy had missed both of their games against Lavadia Tallinn. While Shamrock Rovers manager Stephen Bradley is hoping that Graham Burke will be available for their first leg against Teuta of Albania. That game gets underway at 8. And finally then, Owen and Aisling. Celtic go in search of their first victory under new manager Ange Postecoglou today. They face Czech side FK Jablonec in the Europa League qualifying later. They're in third qualifying round of the Europa League after they fell out of the Champions League with defeat against Midtjylland.
Okay, we have brought you every Lions match today here on Off the Ball, and it all comes to a head this Saturday at 5 o'clock. You can hear the crucial third and final series deciding match live on News Talk. Our coverage will be brought to you in association with Vodafone, lead partner of the British and Irish Lions. Your commentator will be Neil Tracy, who is absolutely hyped, I presume, at this stage on the week.
Yeah, can't wait for it now, to be honest. It's set up absolutely perfectly. If you think back to the last two tours, 2017 in New Zealand, went down to that final game, and the tension around that one, in the end it was a draw. And I know Warren Gatland yesterday was asked about the prospect of, if it was a draw, would you play extra time? And he said he absolutely would. I don't think that's going to happen, to be totally honest. I don't think they can make a change to it now and play out a bit of extra time, but it would be a bit of an anticlimax, I suppose, if it was to be a draw. And then back in 2013, when we had all the controversy around Jonathan Davies being picked ahead of Brian O'Driscoll, and O'Driscoll dropped for the third test, and look at Warren Gatland got it right in the end, because they hammered Australia in the second half of that. So it's a nice change from, you know, 2009 against the Box when it went down to the, and 2005 as well, when it was swept after the opening two games and the third test was a dead rubber. So I think we're going to have a really good game this weekend, really exciting at the very least. I like the two teams. I think I'm slightly leaning towards the Lions, to be totally honest, with the way the teams have been named. I think what Gatland is putting out, not just in terms of a starting 15 but a 23, I think it has a bit more balance to it. I like the fact that Adam Beard is there on the bench, because he's going to be a huge part of disrupting the South African maul in the second half of that game when he comes on. I like the fact that Wyn Jones is back at loosehead prop. I think he was a massive loss in the opening two games, and I think the fact that he's starting, it means you're going to get more out of Mako Vunipola coming off the bench, because I thought in the South Africa A game and in the opening test as well, Mako Vunipola was really, really good when he did come off the bench, and I don't think he had the same impact when he started last week. And then I like to look in the centres as well, of Robbie Henshaw and Bundiaki together, and Josh Adams, who, bizarrely, when you think about it, 8 tries in those first 3 games for him. He hasn't played. He was due to start that. He hasn't played since the week before the first test. So he's completely gone off tour over the last few weeks. And I think he's deserving of a place back in the side as well. And also, as Ross Tucker alluded to just before you let him go, Peter Steph Du Toit missing for South Africa, Faf de Klerk missing for South Africa as well, and the fact that Dwayne Vermeulen hasn't been able to get back in there and prove his fitness to get into the starting 15, I think it's a bit of a leveller.
Any needle at all this week? It seems that it's been relatively interesting, as Gatland always is, but there's been no revenge in the media for last week.
No, and to be honest, I think both sides realised they kind of needed to tone it down a little bit in the build-up. I think you're still going to 100% get that needle out on the pitch.
Yeah.
Similar enough to what we would have had in the first half of the second test last Saturday. But I think Gatland has realised, you know, constantly just poking each other between the, you know, in the media isn't really doing anyone any favours, and it was... I think it was all just a really bad look last week, to be totally honest. It just, the optics of it were pretty terrible. Both sides just making passive-aggressive comments at each other non-stop. The referees getting stuck in the middle, and Ben O'Keefe was left with an absolutely impossible job, as well as the rest of the officials last Saturday as well. So I think it's right that both sides are just toning down the comments to the media this week, and I think you just need to focus on the rugby. I still think all the niggle and all the intensity is going to be there, though, on Saturday.
And the momentum is definitely with South Africa. Do you think, obviously, we've six changes in there too with the Lions. Will they change it up tactically, how they play? What do you think we'll see different from the last test?
I think the Lions certainly are going to change it up. Like having Ali Price back in there ahead of Conor Murray as well, I think it's going to look a lot more like the Lions team of the opening test, where they had a little bit more tempo. And I thought it actually worked quite, like, I know it's, we obviously want to see someone like Conor Murray starting a Lions test, but I think he was actually more effective when he came off the bench to be able to kind of manage the game for the Lions in the second half of that opening test, where Ali Price was able to kind of set the tone and Murray's able to come on and finish the job and manage things really well. Whereas I think in the second test, by the time they were able to make that change, they were into chasing it at that point. So I think the Lions selection, it just seems a bit more sensible all round, I kind of think. And I think you're going to see the Lions looking a lot more like the first test, where they were actually able to improve as the game went on, as opposed to last week where they kind of laid all their cards out in the opening half and weren't really able to lay it love on South Africa in the second half. And I think from South Africa's point of view, I'm curious to see what happens with how they play off scrum half, because as we've always seen, Faf de Klerk kicks the leather off the ball and does so brilliantly. It's not a criticism of him, he does it brilliantly, but obviously he's out injured. Kobus Reinach is in, who would be more known for his ability to run with the ball. He kind of plays almost in the style of Antoine Dupont, where you would have seen him at the 2019 Rugby World Cup, where he's just popping up on everybody's shoulder, left, right and centre, looking for offloads. But I have seen people who have seen a lot more of Kobus Reinach over the last year, 18 months, talking about how his game has developed over the last 12 months, where he left Northampton Saints and moved to Montpellier. And remember as well, he's playing alongside Andre Pollard, who is a clubmate of his at Montpellier as well. So even the fact that South Africa haven't played too much rugby together over the last year or so, they're 9 and 10 are with each other every single day at Montpellier. Now, I know Andre Pollard was out all season with a cruciate, but even just having that little bit of continuity is probably going to be important too.
Absolutely. Well, it's going to be a 5 o'clock kickoff on Saturday. Neil Tracy will be your lead commentator for that. Right, at 18 minutes past nine, I can tell you that OTB AM is brought to you live by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. And right now we're checking in with Ross and Harry Byrne as part of Dublin Simon Community's Run at Home.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
You're headed by Leinster rugby players, brothers and competitors Harry and Ross Byrne, who are taking teams on a virtual run from the 2nd to the 16th of August from Dublin to Rome, covering the host cities of the Six Nations Championship. We have the Dublin Simon Run at Home. On registration, participants will automatically be assigned to Team Ross or Team Harry, with Ross and Harry acting as team captains. Each team will work toward the collective goals of running from the Aviva to the Stadio Olimpico in Rome and back, covering the host stadiums of the Six Nations. 4,364 kilometres to be precise, with a team that has clocked up the most kilometres by August 16th, winning the race. Runners and walkers of all ages and abilities are invited to take part, and you can register now to clock your miles for Dublin Simon's Run at Home with Team Harry and Team Ross. And if you don't have time to run, you can buy some kilometres for your favourite team in the Dublin Simon Run at Home, and you can visit dubsimon.ie/at home for more details. And as you can tell, this thing is up and running. Ross, first of all to you, how are you getting on with this?
Harry is actually in the lead, which is, so I don't know, maybe he's buying a few cheeky kilometres here and there. So I need my team to up their effort slightly, or else try and sign up a few more people and try get an extra walk in here or there. Hopefully the weather stays clear as well, so the rain isn't putting people off.
This must feel pretty good, Harry.
Yeah, I'm enjoying it, to be honest. Definitely enjoying it. We'll see how we go anyway. I'd say it'll even up in a while. But enjoying being in the lead for the moment. But it's early days.
And what is it about you, do you think, that people have decided to join on your team rather than Ross's team?
I'd love to say they didn't pick me, but unfortunately it's randomly selected. So I don't know. Maybe the organisers have just rigged it in my favour.
Well, one thing I actually forgot to ask, lads. This is the third time we've been chatting. I actually forgot to ask, like, how are you guys at running in general? I know you're not, obviously you're a professional athlete, so you're not supposed to be doing anything like this, and you're not actually running as part of this. But Ross, if I were to ask you first, like, are you fond of the old 5K or the 10K? Is endurance your sort of thing?
Certainly not the 10K and 5K.
Even us saying it. Anyway, you've got an engine.
we're not built for the long distance running, that's for sure.
You're the same, Harry.
Yeah, when COVID actually came first and we were in lockdown, I tried to do that 5K and then my calves for the next week were in bits, couldn't walk, were like rocks. So not my specialty either, to be honest.
Well, you're going to have to tell us, what was your 5K time that left your rocks like rocks? Or your calves like rocks, I should say.
It was slow. I actually couldn't tell you. It was very slow.
are out halves generally fast for us?
Not us.
No. probably depends what team they play for. It's probably changed a little bit in the last few years. The position's probably changed. You probably got more players who are probably more athletes, let's say, playing 10 than the traditional game managers, let's say.
Well, that's it. You've got to be able to manage the game so well. You've got to let the ball do the work. There's no need for you to be tiring yourself out. Just kick that ball.
Exactly. Play smart.
Yeah. How do you manage to disguise it yourself, Harry, if you're playing? Any tricks for disguising maybe the rocks or the calves turning to rocks after a period of time?
No, yeah, I suppose then you just try to survive. But if you go, yeah, after about 50 minutes, 60 minutes, a lot of the times your calves are cramping and stuff and you're in bits. But as Ross says, that's when it's time to kick the ball and give it to someone else.
Yeah, for people who've been tuned in for the last few weeks, they know that you're getting back up and running. Pre-season has started again, and I'm kind of interested in what you guys actually do on a day-to-day basis. Ross, we might start with you, but like I'm really interested in the art of kicking. What are you doing on a day-to-day basis to hone that skill?
At the moment, not doing much at all, to be honest, just because we're kind of been straight back into it and we're probably running a lot more than we would be. So I suppose we'll probably pick it up a bit more as we get closer to the actual season. But I probably wouldn't do as much as a lot of people would think. It's more probably doing a little bit less, but making sure it's good quality. That would kind of be how I would have my week. And I wouldn't really have a set number of kicks or certain kicks I need to hit during the week. Once I'm kind of happy with it in my own head, going into the game, I'm generally pretty comfortable.
What does a good quality kicking workout look like?
It would probably depend on if it's post a tough training session or not, or if it's a day off. It's obviously a bit easier because you're refresher and you can get more done. But again, it might depend who we're playing in terms of what our kicking strategy might be for the week in terms of our restarts or kicking out of hand and what areas of the pitch we're looking to target. And then obviously goal kicking is generally just, if you're going well, it's probably just trying to stay in that rhythm. And then if you find you're pulling a few to the left or pushing a few to the right or whatever it is, just trying to, I suppose, fix that little tweak and just trying to make yourself as comfortable as possible. I suppose a bit like how people go to the driving range and trying to fix the swing. But just making sure really you're confident is probably the biggest thing. So then when it comes to the game, you're not standing up praying it's going to go over as opposed to knowing it's going to go over really is the biggest thing.
And is training almost always a sign of how you're going to play at the weekend? Like, when you have a bad training session and all of a sudden come away from a match and like, actually, when the whistle blew, I was on it.
Yeah, it's probably strange. Even, I suppose, as a team, sometimes we train terribly and you're going a bit worried into the game and then you end up playing really well. Or even in, sort of from my own perspective, in the warm-up, sometimes I can't hit a barn door, sometimes off the tee, like it's mad, and then I kick 100%. So I think it is, so much of it is just down to your own head, really. And I suppose mentally, if you can get around that and be confident in yourself, then, because it's you don't get any points for kicks in the warm-up or in training. It's the only ones in the games that matter. So I suppose just trying to get them right.
It's really interesting, yeah. Harry, what about you? What is your routine, if you have one at the moment?
I suppose we'd be, when we're in the normal season, we'd train on a Monday and Tuesday, probably before. Myself and Ross actually would just, like, just before training for like 5 minutes, just be kicking out of hand to each other. But Wednesday would be our day off normally, and then on our day off we'd do generally a full kicking session for like 40 minutes 45 minutes, where you do a bit of everything, whether it's kicking out of hand, as Ross said, depending who you're playing, you kind of go to if what defensive system they kind of run or what players you might want to target, for example. You might do certain kicks to suit that and restart similarly. And then just goal kicking on the exact same, yeah. Even Ross talking about the swing thoughts there, it's the same as golf. I always find when I'm thinking is when I'm kicking at my worst. So right. I always find if I'm feeling good and not thinking at all and just doing it, that's when I'm at my best generally. And he said I've had similar experiences. I think it was it Zebra last year? I think I missed... I've probably hit 20 kicks in the warm-up. I think I missed like 16 or 17. And then the game comes around and I think I was 7 out of 8 or 8 out of 8 or something like that. So it's just sometimes I think just when the whistle goes and you're just kind of feeling it, you're like, then it's fine. It's a weird kind of thing to describe. I kind of always struggle to describe it, but it's kind of a feel thing for me, as opposed to people would always be kind of talking about process and stuff. If I'm feeling good, generally they go over.
It's kind of a flow stage, is it?
A little bit, yeah. People talk about that a bit. I'd be like that as well when I'm playing. I think when I'm not thinking, I'm probably playing at my best. Like, probably obviously I'm thinking, but just don't. It's not consciously thinking about just kind of doing it, which is the exact same with kicking, to be honest. When I kick badly in games, I'm thinking about something I've done wrong, or that's when the swing thoughts come in, and that's when the trouble starts. So less is more for me. Thinking, bro.
Yeah. I'm going to ask if you do much work on the mental side, like even in terms of like away from the pitch, but it sounds like actually the more work you put into it or the more you feel like you're working on it, it's kind of like a counterproductive process. Is that fair to say?
Potentially, yeah. Well, like there is a bit of mindfulness and stuff that we've tried before. They did wrong pass in Leinster. I wouldn't be massively into it though, to be honest. Like kind of similar to Ross, like I just feel if I'm feeling good, the confidence is there, then I'm generally good to go.
And that seems to be the thing, Ross, when it comes to highly specialised positions like yourselves, there is no one-size-fits-all approach.
No, I don't think so. I like how Harry's saying he gets in the flow state there. Harry just gets bored when he does too much of the same thing. That's why he's saying he doesn't think about it.
Yeah, Ed Farrell, the kicking coach, actually hates me at times because I'll just be doing mental kicking training.
He distracts all the other kickers.
It's like, will you leave? Will you go away?
But no, I think it is. Yeah, it is. I don't think it's there's no one process for everyone. I think everyone's a little bit different. And it's probably just trying to find what's best for you. And what works for you now might not work for you in 6 months' time as well. So it's probably just trying to get yourself in a rhythm and then maintain that as best as possible for as long as possible, and then you might need to tweak a little bit because even you can get it can get a little bit repetitive, or I don't know if you get your body gets bored is the right thing to say, but I suppose even just to kind of keep yourself fresh and have little cues here and there, and just so I suppose you keep yourself, I suppose, focused really.
What would your cue be?
It could probably vary, to be honest, on different things. It could be just really simple things like trying to make good contact with the ball, like as in I wouldn't really have like loads of technical cues. As Harry's kind of saying, like we probably wouldn't really be like, I don't know, if someone was to analyze our actual kicking, would we be very technical in terms of we need to approach the ball here and there? Probably not. It's probably just even how we've grown up, just kind of kicking the ball back and forth if it was a football or whatever when we're younger and stuff. So it's more just kind of getting myself into a comfortable position. I know, get myself into a good position and make good contact with the ball. And then sort of like, it'd just be little things like that. Nothing too complicated, to be honest.
That's really interesting. That's really interesting insight. You mentioned there that you're in pre-season. I mean, like when we were talking about the Dublin Simon run at home there a moment ago and your ability or otherwise to be able to do this, I presume after a little bit of Leinster pre-season training, you guys would be absolutely fine to do this.
I hope so, yeah. yeah, if it was in 3 weeks' time, we'd be winning, yeah, definitely. with the amount of running we're doing at the moment, yeah, I would definitely hope so.
Because when we talk to people from a whole range of sports, especially after they finish their careers, they always talk maybe about in rugby, the amateur days are in GAA basically all the time up until like 2009, 2010. They always talk about pre-season just being the just a horrible, horrible place to be. But I assume, Harry, that's not how a professional setup works in 2021. You all come back in at the start of the summer in pretty decent nick.
It depends. Yes and no. Yeah, the first 3 weeks you're definitely working off a bit of a belly or something, but it goes really quickly enough. But no, yeah, no matter. I don't think it matters any of the sport. I think pretty much everyone is preseason is pretty much hell when it's that hard. Like, but especially when you're in the heat like that. But it's a necessary evil, unfortunately.
We got both of your takes on the kicking in the Lions this time last week, and there was a lot more kicking, as it turned out, in the second test. How do you see the final test going? Harry, we might start with you.
No, it's interesting. They're pretty physical, the South Africans, aren't they? Yeah. And the 6-2 split reverting back to type definitely worked for them. So I don't know. Like, I think it's going to be very tight. Obviously, Lions as well, the backline picking Bundy as well, getting a bit more physicality in the centre, I think, moving Robert to 13 would be interesting. They obviously know each other very well. So I'd say a few partnerships that are kind of, hopefully, you think, developing a bit. And I don't know. It's tough to call. It'll be interesting to see, to be honest.
Listen, I mean, there was so many breaks in play last Saturday, and the way you guys are talking today, that would sit you guys down to the ground. Ross, like, I mean, 2 hours and 15 minutes to play 80 minutes of rugby, that's easy, isn't it?
Oh god, it was painful to watch. It's I think it's everything we don't want in rugby, but unfortunately it's kind of the way it's gone a little bit lately. The first half was well over an hour, so it's hopefully this game is a bit more open and Dan Bigger gets to pass ball more than three times, which would be it's just interesting, I suppose, which way the Lions go, because, you know, everyone knows what way South Africa are going to play, and it's hard to argue considering they won the World Cup playing that way. So it'd be interesting to see if the Lions do play a bit more openly in some of their selections as well, and even players on the bench they have, obviously with Sam Simmons and Finn Russell, it would suggest that's what they're going to try and do in the last 20 minutes maybe. So it'll be interesting to see if they can, I suppose, hang in maybe until then and then maybe try and open the game up.
Yeah, for sure. It's going to be an absolute cracker, no doubt, this Saturday. But the big clash, the big rugby clash, of course, is Team Ross, Team Harry at the moment. Ross trailing. That is the big rugby news this morning. Just to remind you that it's spearheaded by Leinster rugby players, brothers and competitors, Harry and Ross Byrne. They were taking teams on a virtual run, which began on the 2nd of August, but you can still sign up. It's going until the 16th of August, from Dublin to Rome, covering the host cities of the Six Nations Championship. It is the Dublin Simon Run at Home. And on registration, participants will automatically be assigned to Team Ross or Team Harry, with Ross and Harry acting as team captains. Each team will then work towards the collective goals of running from the Aviva Stadium to the Stadio Olimpico in Rome and back, covering the host cities of the Six Nations, with the team that has clocked up the most kilometres by August 16th, winning the race. Runners and walkers of all ages and abilities are invited to take part. And you can absolutely still register now and continue to register over the next little while. Clock your miles for Dublin Simon's Run at Home with Team Harry and Team Ross. And remember, if you don't have time to run, you can buy some kilometres for your favourite team in the Dublin Simon Run at Home. Just visit dubsimon.ie/runathome. Harry Byrne, Ross Byrne, thank you so much.
Thanks very much, cheers.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
Yeah, 9:34 on this Thursday morning, and OTB AM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning, start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors.
OTB AM.
With Gillette, put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.
At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.